Hi, I'm Tom, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here tonight. I was at my home group on Tuesday night. My Tuesday night meeting is called the Oakland Tuesday Night Meeting because we wanted to give information, you know. And we almost named it the Oakland Tuesday Night 6:30 Meeting, but we thought that was too long. But that's my home group meeting, and I've been going there for a long, long time. And on a regular basis, people gather, and we share experience and strength and hope. And that's what I hope I get to do tonight. There are visitors and newcomers, and it takes a while to learn how to listen in Alcoholics Anonymous. It also takes a while to learn how to talk in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to meetings where the conversation is, well, last week's speaker was better, you know. It's kind of like getting a movie review, you know, in some areas. So I just want you to know that if there's anything I say tonight that's helpful, please use it. And if it's not helpful, don't worry about it. I only speak for myself. I have my own point of view, and you get to have yours. You get to have your own understanding on all sorts of things in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I needed to hear that when I got here. I needed to know that I could take what I needed and leave the rest for later, but leave the rest and take what I needed. And a couple months ago, I heard someone say, take what you like, and that's not quite the same thing. Some of the things I needed, I didn't really like very much, but I really needed them. Some data on me so you can get me on your screen. I'm 58 years old. I got sober in August of 1976. It was during the Ford presidency. I got sober, as a matter of fact, during the Republican convention. I wasn't there, but it was on TV, and it was all that was going on, and I remember watching that. I got sober because I got intervened on. I'm not one of those people who say, gee, I'm in trouble, I think I'll reach out for help. I'm not one of those people. I think, gee, I'm in trouble, I hate you. That's how I approach my life, and I'm sure a lot of this is your fault. And I was content to be drowning in a sea of booze, and some people loved me, and they had some information, and they had just thought I was a jerk or crazy for years, and then someone explained alcoholism, and they connected the dots and looked at me, and I got put into treatment, and I'm glad for that. I was in treatment for 21 days in Berkeley, California, where I was going to school, and the treatment center was very AA-friendly. AA people came in to talk to us, and we went out to meetings, and I'm a lucky man, because I liked meetings almost right away. I liked meetings better than the treatment center. I didn't like everybody at meetings, and I didn't like every meeting, but I liked meetings. My sponsor says that if you like everybody you've met at meetings, it's a good sign you haven't been to enough meetings, because some of us really aren't very likable, you know? I should mention that I drank. I'm from an alcohol. There's a lot of alcoholism in my family. Most of us were pretty functional. A couple of us over the generations disappeared, and we kind of know where they are. I have one half of the family comes right from Ireland, and the other half comes from Sweden. And there's a lot of alcoholism on both sides. The Swedes all became alcoholic farmers in the Santa Clara Valley and in Minnesota, and the Irish did other things. One became the chief gardener at Stanford University for a long, long time, and others went into business and things, and a couple went to work for the water company. And then there was a couple that just disappeared, and they would say, well, we don't know where they ended up, and we do. You know, Skid Row in Chicago or Boston or New York, one of those places, that's where they ended up. I'm the first member of my family to get sober, not the last, but the first, and I'm the first member of my peer group to get sober. I ran with a whole bunch of folks, and they considered me to be the worst alcoholic in the whole crowd, and I guess I was, but I got sober just in time. I'm a daily drinker, and I'm a snob. I had pretensions around my drinking. There were certain things I would not drink, of course, unless there was nothing else, and then I would drink them. I liked gin. I liked wine of all flavor. I liked beer in all flavors. I would drink it complaining, but I'd drink it. Bourbon. I tried scotch and milk for a while. No one would think that you were drinking scotch if you were drinking milk. I hid my drinking for a while. I drank for a while out of coffee cups because I didn't think people would notice I wasn't drinking coffee if it was in the cup. I'm a falling down drunk. I would regularly fall over and hurt myself. I was black and blue in lots of places. I had rug burns on my face regularly. I know where those come from. Also, I'm a drunk driver. I got my driver's license when I was 16 years old, and within a month, I think I was drinking and driving, and I never killed anybody, and I never, crashed up a car, but that's just waiting for the next time, and I'm very clear on that. I was stopped once or twice for weaving, and the cop just said, get home, and I'd go home. But when drinking, I'm capable of very bad behavior that will risk other people's lives. What else is going on? I heard a sober physician describe alcoholism as being a disease that has three distinct phases to it. Phase one is the fun phase. This is when it's fun. And I'll have to tell you that I had fun drinking for a long time. Drinking really was enjoyable. I laughed, I cried, I became clever, I could dance, I had energy, we could do wild things. Drinking was just instant fun, especially when I was a high school kid, because I was geeky and awkward and I was a sissy and I didn't know how to throw a baseball and I didn't feel like I belonged or fit in. But I discovered at the age of 17 that I could drink guys three times my size under the table. And suddenly all my problems went away. I knew I was very mature. I knew I was very strong. I knew I was very masculine. I knew I was just, throbbing with testosterone. I was sober for a couple of years before they told me that huge capacity to drink doesn't mean masculine, it means alcoholic. And I went, oh, really? Fun, stage two alcoholism is called fun plus problems. It's still fun, but you start to have problems, and I sure did. I remember my senior year in high school, the big exam is the college entrance exams, and you're supposed to show up for those, and you study for those, and you prep for those, and I had been out the night before and had 8 or 12 beers and showed up for that very important exam so hungover that my teeth hurt when I wrote. And it was awful. It was awful. I felt like my brain had been cleaved in half. And I didn't have a lot of hangovers, but that was one. Started to have problems. I started to get the mood swings that we call Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. By the way, a month or so ago, I was asked to come over to University of San Francisco at California Medical Hospital. This is where they teach doctors. And they're having a program for doctors on spirituality. And doctors treat all kinds of people, so they want to give doctors information. And so once a week, they have a quote-unquote spiritual person come and talk to the doctors about their background, their faith, and they've had rabbis there, and they've had imams there, and they've had people explaining Buddhism there. I am a Catholic priest, and this woman called me and said, will you come, you have a whole hour, will you explain 12 steps and Christianity? And I, two for the price of one, you know, I'd be happy to do it. And I talked a little bit about Christian stuff, and then I said, well, you can read all that. I'd like to talk to you about alcoholism, because I'm afraid that this is the only time you're going to hear anybody talk about it, and you're doctors. So I talked about the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind and how crazy thinking is and denial and how important meetings are. And as physicians, it would be very helpful if they knew something about recovery. And then we took questions and stuff. But I recommended some books for them to read, one of which was, of course, the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, especially the doctor's opinion. I said, even though it's written in 1939, you might find it very, very interesting. And I read a little bit of it to them. And then I mentioned a few other things. And I suggested that they also read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I said, you're kind of professionally, you should read this. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that would happen to me. I would be a very nice, friendly person and have a couple of beers and have that change in personality. And I would become foul-tempered and loud. I'm not physically violent, but I was verbally very violent. And I used a lot of sarcasm and ridicule loud. And I would attack whoever happened to be there. And one of my classmates referred to me as being nothing but piss and vinegar. And I didn't know that was a critique. I thought that was a kind of compliment, you know, but it's not. But that was true for a very, very long time. And I was sober, and I stayed very sarcastic. And I used ridicule a lot for a long, long time as a sober person. It was my defense, and it was my attack. And for a long time, I really thought I had to be defended all the time and attack all the time. That took a long time. The mood switch changes. Yeah, I was somewhere sober a couple of months, and I went to an AA clubhouse, and I wasn't sure whether I was alcoholic. Maybe I was just crazy. Maybe I was just having a run of bad luck. So I asked this old-timer, do you think I'm alcoholic? And he said, Tom, I don't know if you're alcoholic. I know I'm alcoholic. And I said, how do you know that? Now, please notice that he wasn't diagnosing me. He was diagnosing himself, which is also very AA. I don't know if you are, but I can tell you I am, because I am not an expert on you. I'm an expert on me. He said, well, I know I'm an alcoholic because I can't control my behavior after my first drink. Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, there were times I could drink a lot and nothing would happen, nothing. Other times I would drink just a little and anything could happen. And I never knew which one it was going to be. And that is the story of my drinking. A successful night, you know. The definition of that changed. And towards the end, a successful night was if I woke up in my own bed, no vomit, no pee, success. You know, another, you're doing really well, Tom. I tried not drinking as I would get into trouble. I mean, I'd also have blackouts, you know, and that's where you don't remember stuff, but you were doing stuff, and I'd have conversations in blackouts, and I have driven in blackouts, and I've been involved in fights in blackouts. I didn't call on the telephone, for which I'm very grateful. I do have friends that did call on the telephone in blackouts, and they were always terrified of the phone bill coming, because they knew that, you know, who do I know in New Zealand? You know, well, clearly a lot of people. Fun plus problems. Stage 3 alcoholism is just called problems. You know, the good times are over. Never again can we recapture the great moments of the past. I used alcohol for everything. I used it as my boon companion. I used alcohol as medicine. I used it as courage. I used it as solace. I used it as companionship. I used it as a reward. Everything in my life revolved around alcohol. And I, when I no longer had alcohol in my life, I was very maladjusted. It just took a long time to learn how to do anything again. I was 6 or 7 months sober the first time I danced sober, and it was really awful. Everything hurt, and there was no sense of rhythm, and I kept expecting to fall over at any moment. It was really awful. Christmas came that year. I got sober in August. And that year, Christmas was on the 25th of December, and in my family, we'd gather on Christmas Eve. This is how they do it, and there was such tension. There was lots of difficulties and stresses. We had Irish Catholic Democrats and Swedish Lutheran Republicans and Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons. The only nice ones were the Mormons. And people would gather together and talk or not, depending on the case. A lot of tension just vibrating in the room, and I would be very anxious, and always before with my family of brothers and their wives and cousins and in-laws, drinking helped a lot. But this time I wasn't drinking, and I hadn't had a drink since August, so that was around 3 or 4 months, and I felt just raw. And what I felt like, the right analogy is as if I didn't have skin on. My nerves were just exposed and raw, and I was overreacting to stuff. And I thought I was going crazy because I was having feelings. I'm having an emotion. I must be losing my mind. That is not rational, but that's really how I understood it. And I was highly anxious, and I went to my folks' house. I was living in Berkeley, and they lived in San Jose, about an hour away. And my mom noticed how jumpy I was, and she said, "Tom, what's wrong?" Now, I thought she wanted to know. They don't want to know. What they want to hear is, "I've got a little diarrhea and a cold. Other than that, there's no..." Oh, fine, we can handle that. But I thought she wanted to know. You know, a moment of mother-son intimacy. And I said, "Well, I'm alcoholic, and I haven't had a drink since August, and I'm pretty nervous about tonight." And she was setting the table, and she put down the silverware and looked at me and said, "You'll ruin Christmas." Only alcoholics laugh at that, I want you to know. When you mention that in churches, people cry. And I realized that I had completely misread the situation. I mean, and I want to let you know this, I continue to misread situations. I mean, just because I'm sober doesn't mean I have honed in on reality. I'm the youngest, and I know how to get out of messy situations, and I use charm and humor and all kinds of things to, you know, run for the border. And I said, "Oh, okay, listen, it's not alcoholism, but it's a drinking problem. I've got this drinking problem." And she said, "Oh, well, that's all right. We have a lot of those. Just don't be alcoholic, because that word ruins careers." Whew. A couple years later, I was driving with my folks. I was driving. They were in my mom over here and my dad in the back seat. I liked to drive. And out of nowhere, my mom said, "How bad was it?" This has been like 3 years after I mentioned my alcoholism. "How bad was it?" And I didn't have to say how bad was what. I knew what she was talking about, because it was a capital I, you know, it. And by this time, I had done, like the fellow from Oklahoma, I'd done a fourth and fifth step. And I wasn't going to do one with my folks. Thank you very much. And I was able to say in a nice, calm way, "It was bad enough so that I never want to drink again." Silence. 2 or 3 or 4 years later, we're driving somewhere, and my mom's here, my dad's back there, and she said, "Why didn't you come to us?" Which is kind of like the, you know, if the beaver had gone to his parents and told him he was alcoholic, it would have been all worked out. And by this time, I had more sobriety and some Al-Anon, thank God, and I, a little breathing space, said, "Why didn't you come to us?" And my first reaction, of course, was just to pull into oncoming traffic and end the whole comedy. But instead, I breathed in and out, and I said, "What could you have done?" And she said, "I don't know." And I said, "Exactly. I had to go someplace where they knew what to do." And for me, that really has been Alcoholics Anonymous. People here know what to do. There's such practicality in the room. And my oldest brother became sober a few years later, and his oldest daughter is sober now, and we can go to meetings together and we can have simple conversations. But the family can absolutely knock me to pieces if I'm not balanced and breathing in and out. And one Christmas, I mean, you know, it's that time. One Christmas, I went to one of my brother's homes, and he was drinking, and his in-laws were there, the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Sicilians. And the TV was on and the radio was on, and they were arguing about, I don't know, Korea. I don't know what they were arguing about. And there were a few other really awful things, and I needed a meeting. I needed a meeting real bad. And I was clear enough that I just told the people, "I have to go now. I'll be back in an hour and a half." And I went to a little meeting in a tiny town in Northern California called Marysville. And there were 4 of us at the meeting. There was the guy running the meeting who was doing service that night. It was December 25th. He was there to open the door and let people in. There was another local alcoholic who looked a little odd. And then there was myself and a woman who was also visiting her family for the holidays, and her eyes were as wide as saucers. So we were all glad to be there, and we read the stuff you read, and then what's the topic? And the local alcoholic resident had as his topic, "Why won't they let me bring my knife into the meetings?" Merry Christmas, you know, we kind of discussed the common welfare, you know, and the common safety and criminal codes, things like that. I'm frequently pretty glad to be sober. I want you to know that. This past year, I am. Half of my life has been spent in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been sober for half of my life, and you'd think I'd be better by now. But what I find is I continue getting into the difficulties of life. I was doing a talk. They asked me to come to the School of Theology, where I went to school. In the Jesuit community, I remember the Jesuit community, that means something for you to you from Catholic backgrounds. Otherwise, don't worry about it. But our tradition is we spend a lot of time in school, and I was drunk for my first 2 years of studies in Berkeley there, and then I got sober for my third year. And my third year, I went to meetings a lot and learned a lot and learned how to do things a lot. But I was pretty crazy. And I left there in 1977. I was ordained a priest in 1978. This is ancient history. And this past year, they asked me to come and talk to the guys in school now about what it's like. And I went and told them about being sober and being drunk and alcoholism and what it's like and the kind of work I do and what it's like to be in my skin. And one of them, a guy from Portland, Oregon, he said, "Well, is it easier now than it was before?" And I said, "No, it's really not. I don't think it's easy. I've learned some skills. Before, I had no skills other than vodka. But I've learned some skills, and I've learned how to take care of myself better, and I've learned when it's time to leave, and I've learned when it's time to start, and I've learned when it's time to ask for help. But it's not easier, but it's better. It's a lot better being alive today. But I'm having a lot of defects of character cropping up. I get tired and cranky, and I want to push people downstairs. You probably never want to do that. It's bad when the local priest pushes people downstairs. But some, as they say in Texas, she needed killing, you know, and I know some of those people. So I was going through the book with somebody. I don't read the book every day, but I like it, and I know, like, in churches, we alcoholics will fight about almost anything, and I've been to meetings where, you know, people did start fighting over how much of the book must you read, and how much of the book is true, and how much literature, and should we have other things, and I'm all for the first 164 pages, and I really like the stories in the back, and I have this radical point of view on literature. Anything that helps, you can use. That's what I believe. And I can't find this thing. I should have found it earlier. There's a story in here about the first guy from Chicago that gets sober. And as you know, alcoholics in Chicago are very bad drunks. And this guy is a young man, and he ends up in Akron, Ohio, here it is, talking to Dr. Bob. And in the fourth edition of the book, it's on page 263, and he talks about hooking up with Dr. Bob. The day before I was due to go back to Chicago, it was Dr. Bob's afternoon off, he had me to the office. He had me to the office. There's no verb there. Had me down to, I mean, it's invited me there, it's odd. And we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the six-step program as it was at that time. The six steps were, 1, complete deflation. 2, dependence and guidance from a higher power. 3, moral inventory. 4, confession. 5, restitution. 6, continue to work with other alcoholics. Dr. Bob led me through all of these steps. Bill will take those and make them into 12. At the moral inventory, he brought up several of my bad personality traits. Now, haven't you ever wanted to do that with someone you sponsored? Just to say, listen, before you say anything, I'd just like to point out a few things I've noticed. It's how they did it in Akron, evidently, and I think the operating principle is this. If I see something in you, especially if it bothers me, but if I see something in you, there's a chance it's gone on inside of me. If it really bothers me, there's a real good chance it's gone on inside of me. I used to travel with a friend of mine, and I simply can't travel with him anymore because he's me only worse. And it just this mirror looking at me all the time, and I get so discouraged. I was talking somewhere, and I really upset somebody, and she came up to me, and she said, "You're so arrogant!" I mean, this is not a secret, you know. And I wanted to say, are you identifying or comparing, you know, because, yes, must be nice not to be arrogant, but being that I have a perfect Al-Anon program, I didn't say any of those things. He brought up several of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentments. Now, I was about 20 years sober when I read those the first time. I mean, when I actually noticed them on the page. Selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentments. And I'd like you to know that those are my defects of character. And they have not been removed. My experience is daily reprieve. If I do some prayer and meditation and get to a meeting and talk to the worst of my sponsees nicely, those don't bother me very much, but if I cut corners and cut back on meetings and, you know, do a few other things that aren't quite admirable, they come up in groups of 2 and 3 and catch me completely by surprise, And then in my 20s of recovery, I have found that the 10th step is a very well-practiced step. I have to admit when I'm wrong, and I'm wrong a lot. I mean, I really am. I'm not just doing that so you'll say, oh, you're so humble. I'm really wrong a lot. And my sponsees will know that. And when I do something stupid with them where I treat them badly or unfairly or like act like a jerk, I've got to clean that up right away. And I think that might be the best thing I do in alcoholics. That's what I'm teaching them, is to apologize and clean up. It's not to be a source of virtue for countless millions and... You know, that's not it. I'd like to talk a little bit more about defects of character, and this is, I have never done this before, and this might be a terrible mistake, and if it causes resentments, you can check in with your sponsor after the meeting. Not me, I'm going home tomorrow, but you can... I'm a reader. I read a lot. And I've been reading Dickens again. And this is on the thing of defects of character now. And I'm going to do shortly a little bit of Charles Dickens. The Christmas Carol is a story of one man's spiritual awakening. And he's a real bleak figure called Ebenezer Scrooge. And he's hard-hearted and a miser and cruel and heartless and just there's no spirit there. There's nothing but cruelty and avarice. I was teaching English in China a few years ago. I go back over to Asia to do that. I was teaching Chinese English teachers. And when Chinese students start learning English, they're frequently given an English name so that their English teachers know who they are because the Chinese names are very complicated and we're just not quick enough to pick up on them. And we had, Robins and Georges and Henrys. One young man was named Snake. I don't know what that's about. There was a woman named Winner, and I tried to explain to her that Victoria would be a better, but she wasn't interested. And there was a bright young fellow named Brain, and it took me about a month to realize they meant Brian. You know, but it went that way. So the names were wonderful, and but they did not know each other's English names. Only the teachers knew their English names. It was a big secret. And one of the guys didn't have a name yet. Young man in his 20s, and we were doing a little bit of Dickens. They can read and write like Shakespeare, but they can't talk. There are more people in China that read and write English than who speak English in North America. But they can't talk. So let's get them talking. And anyway, we were going to do a bit of reading of Christmas Carol, because their English was that good. And I was tempted to name this young man Ebenezer. But that would be a bad thing. That would not be a sober act. And... I hadn't been to a meeting in about a month at that point. And instead we named him Jacob, as in Jacob Marley. And I still get letters signed Jacob from him. Anyway, this is a little picture of Ebenezer Scrooge's spiritual life. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. Nice, just nice. Hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire. Secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. Now, the next time you have been isolating and not going to meetings and not returning phone calls, when you go back to meetings, instead of saying, I've been isolating, which is so boring and American, you might say, I have been secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. And if you do that in Los Angeles, someone will come up to you and say, are you a writer? The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. No one ever stopped him in the street to say with gladsome looks, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When will you come to visit me?" No beggars implored him to bestow a trifle. No children asked him what time it was. No man or woman once ever in all his life inquired the way to such and such a place of Scrooge. The man needs meetings. The man needs friends. The man needs allies and companions. And how on earth do you break through that big, thick wall to get inside? And thus you have the three ghosts coming, you know. It's a great story of a spiritual awakening. When I got here, Scrooge isn't my idea of me. I was a lot more scattered and depressed than Scrooge. But I like depressants, and I was very shut down, and I simply had no way of knowing how to do anything. I had a lot of ideas. I didn't know if any of them were mine. I had very few feelings. I preferred numb. And when I was sober for a little while, I could honestly tell you I was not sure what the difference was between right or wrong, good or evil, pleasure or pain. Theoretically, I could argue all that stuff, but I didn't know it. And what I had to do was regularly be at a place where women and men talked about this stuff and acted about this stuff. We had one woman when I was newly sober. Her name was Bonnie L., and she was from Brooklyn, and she had a very thick, broad Brooklyn accent, and you always knew where Bonnie was talking. And she had little emotional control, we would say. She'd yell at meetings, and she'd cry at meetings, and she'd stamp her feet at meetings, and she would burst into tears at meetings. And I loved being at meetings when she did that, because she was doing it because I couldn't. I was a very shut down fellow. And slowly, slowly, slowly over time, I started waking up. All those emotions I mentioned before, I thought I was going crazy. And I heard someone at a meeting talk about being on the roller coaster. Up, down, up, down, up, down. And I no one else had done that. Everyone else was so grateful and happy all the time that I realized that there were two of us, you know, because I was going up and down and feeling very scattered, and it took a long time to rebuild what I would call a recognizable human life. I stayed in school for the rest of that year, graduated, went back to teach, and I moved to Los Angeles to teach. And where I got sober, we did not do it the LA way. LA is very happy and perky, with greeters at the door in well-lit rooms. And we didn't have greeters at the door, and we didn't have well-lit rooms, and we were all depressed, and we quoted our therapist a lot, which seemed to work for me. But I went to meetings in Southern California, and the style and the rhythm was so different, it created a huge shock for me. And so here's the rule. Wherever you get sober is where they do it right. And if you go anywhere else, you're amazed they function at all. And it was so uncomfortable for a long time that it took a while to get comfortable at meetings down there, but there was nowhere else to go. I finally asked my sponsor, I mean, you have to use them for something, you know. I finally said, "Are there any small meetings in Southern California?" And he said, "Try a big book study." They are always small. That seems to be the rule. I don't know whether New York officially has, you know, the 13th tradition. And I started going to this meeting at a Korean church on Olympic Boulevard on Friday nights. There were 18 people there regularly. I was 30. These were people who were in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and they became my first friends. And we did some things like celebrating the holidays. How do you do that? I had to learn how to do that slowly, and I found this time of the year, there's some stuff I like to do, and there's some stuff I don't like to do. And I don't do stuff I don't like to do. And a lot of times in the holidays, I fly pretty low. I want to watch expectations. I want to make sure I get enough sleep. It's really dark and cold on the planet, at least in our hemisphere. And any mammal with a brain is hibernating. But we're up, you know. And why am I a little moody? Why do I feel so depressed? Well, your body knows the sun's going away. Trust me. And your body does not know the sun's ever coming back. So it's a lot of it's physical. I find I get a lot of sleep. I want to get to some meetings. I want to light lights in the darkness. I want to return phone calls. And some people are very fragile this time of year. I'm not fragile. I'm just a little depressed this time of year. But I'm a Scandinavian, so we think that's a good life. But for the fragile folks, the reaching out, the making sure that people have a place to come and that, you know, the doors are open, come on in. That's an important thing. I noticed as we started the meeting tonight, they said, you know, AA is open Christmas Eve. AA is open New Year's Eve. Oh, you bet we are, you know, and we're glad to see you. You don't have to tough it out. Lots of places have marathon meetings and lots of places have telephones. I always thought Alexander Graham Bell should be given an honorary membership in AA. A lot of lives have been saved by the telephone and the internet too. People go on lines to meetings, and there are some sober folks I know all over the world who, just check in with each other. My friend from Texas, she used the phone a lot, and she knew people all over the world, and she said, some friends think that I only like them for their time zone, you know, because she'd be up at 3 a.m. in Texas, and somebody in Hawaii was awake, you know, call. So I'm glad to be here tonight. I hope today's a good day. I think we are given the gift of life for a second time, and we should share it and celebrate it and be grateful. Thanks.